harnessing my hostility. You know, I was reading in a book called The Art of Understanding Yourself by Cecil Osborne, and I came across a story I'd like to share with you of a girl named Christine. Christine was 3 years old when her father went to prison. And for as long as she could remember, she had felt a deep sense of shame over the fact that her father was a convict. And Christine and her mother lived with grandparents. And her grandfather was a very stern, unloving, authoritarian man. And when her father was out on parole, she was just intensely afraid of him because of his violent outbursts of rage. And he never paid her a compliment, never expressed any love in her whole life, and repeatedly told her she was stupid. And when she was 15, he tried to molest her sexually. Well, she grew up to be a very quiet, inhibited person, and married at the age of 20 and had 2 children. But she found, to her distress, that it was very difficult for her to accept her children with love. She came to a retreat that Mr. Osborne was at, and she was obviously struggling with a deep inner conflict. And one day she blurted out, "I'm sick and tired of bearing my father's guilt." And slowly she began to share her problem and to realize for the first in time the extent of the violent inner hostility she felt toward her father. She had never let herself feel it that way before. And she was assured that it was all right to feel whatever emotion she was experiencing. It may not be all right to let them control, but it's all right to feel them. And so she began to face her inner need and her pent-up hostility, and she was able to forgive her father. But you know, strangely, her relationship with her husband began to get worse. She would feel some violent, unreasoning and antagonism to him at certain points. And sometimes she couldn't stand to be in the same room with him. Well, she joined a small group fellowship where they could honestly communicate with one another, and she began to realize that she had admitted and partially forgiven her father, but she had not been able to totally abandon the hostility within her, and so she had focused it in now, transferred it over to her husband. And then she made a new significant step forward in which she truly surrendered all that inner hostility to God. And she said that for the first time in her life, God became a reality to her. Instead of being someone way up there somewhere, she experienced him as part of herself, dwelling within her. And she began to become a new person, more tolerant of others, able to love and help others. Before, she had been too afraid of them to help them. And the hostility and the fear and guilt in her life were replaced with love. Now, there's one exciting thing that stands out in this story about Christine, and that is that God is able to deliver people regardless of their background and regardless of the depth of their inner need. And another that stands out is that honest communicating with someone else, often in a loving small group fellowship, can provide both insight and the climate that enables us to face ourselves realistically and to find release. Now, some of you here may identify with Christine because of your own background or because of feelings that you recognize within yourself. And others may feel, well, that's great for someone like Christine, but compared with her, I don't even have a hostility problem. It's nil compared to hers. And others may think, well, I'm not really sure why I'm here. I don't have any hostility problem. But, well, it'll be nice to have something to help others with. And you may be right. But you also may be surprised, because sometimes when we discover just what attitudes are covered by the term hostility and how they can function beneath the surface in our lives where we buried them long ago and are not aware of them, sometimes we realize we have more than we knew. They can be like a shark under the surface of the water, just with a fin showing now and then. You know, I never did feel I had no hostilities. In fact, it was many years ago that surface eruptions of hostility with my sister made me realize that I just didn't have what it took to produce Christian love. And it began to prepare the soil in my life to really realize that Christ was my life and the only one that could produce Christian love in me. And through that realization, I began to experience a new release. But as the years went by, I've gradually become aware of other hostilities that I hadn't recognized before. I felt that hostility was a very, very minor problem in my life, but with new insights and new growth, I'd become aware of new areas and new insights that have helped me in more fully overcoming hostility. And even within the past year or the past months, I've been able to be to face more fully a couple sharks under the surface of my life and to find greater joy and greater love and greater release. So it's a lifelong process, and we may need this topic more than we realize. Often, there are many confusions about hostility that clutter our minds. And these false beliefs about it can hinder us from harnessing it. We're not going to harness something that we don't think is there or that we think is fine the way it is. And I trust this morning that we can add some clarity to our thinking and learn to admit our own personal assortment of hostile feelings and to see them for what they are and to learn to think the truth in new ways. Now, anger in itself is not wrong. God is angry against evil and sin and injustice. And Christ is portrayed as angry at times, especially against hypocrisy. And anger is a healthy function. It's part of the human apparatus, the ability to feel hostility, as we've seen in previous lectures. Anger against sin and wrong is good, especially if it's primarily directed against the wrong in our own lives, the injustice and unfairness in our own lives toward others. But the way we handle our anger is often wrong. In the book of Ephesians, we read, "If angry, beware of sinning." And we sin if we nurse our anger so that it becomes a resentment. We sin if we let it get out of control. We don't need to apologize for feeling anger, but we need to admit it to ourselves and deal with it. And we do need to apologize for doing or saying things that are unloving or destructive because of our anger or letting it disrupt our relationships. Now, later on, I would suggest that you give some attention to the pages in your notes further on which deal with misconceptions about hostility. And we won't cover them now, but I think that they could help you. There are a number that I'll just briefly mention. One is that it's psychologically harmful not to vent my hostile feelings whenever they arise. And another is that angry explosions must be right at times because they accomplish good results. That's never a good reason to believe something's right, because the end does not justify the means. Another is that angry outbursts are a sign of a forceful personality. Well, they may be a sign of a potentially forceful personality, but when they occur in our lives, they're a sign of a weak, deep inner weakness. Another is that insight into the past influences that caused our hostilities will automatically bring release. And there are people who have uncovered all the past insights into who and what caused their hostility, and then they go through their life blaming those other causes and living with their hostility instead of overcoming it. Let's consider some of the attitudes and feelings that are covered by that umbrella term, hostility. I'm sure that all of us would recognize explosive anger as hostility and hate. And we probably experience other emotions or reactions that we would label hostility, such as irrational grudges or violent antagonism towards someone, or resentments that nibble away at our love. And yet, though we label some things hostility, we may miss other things. And one day I was paging through a number of books in the New Testament, noting some of the references it makes toward hostility and what it called it. And you know, this is the great thing about the Bible, that it communicates to the actual human situation. It doesn't present its heroes as unrealistic, perfect men. For example, the great apostle Paul and Barnabas are shown at one point as having a sharp disagreement and some irritation with one another. Now, as I leafed through, I found various expressions such as malice, envy, jealousy, squabbling, spite, losing patience, compiling statistics of evil. You know, now you've done this and this and this, and so we add up the score. Rivalry, slander, malicious remarks, evil thoughts and words about others, treating others with contempt, judging, threatening revenge, bringing insulting criticisms, and harboring bitterness. All these are hostilities. And hostility can occur in our lives or exist on various levels or in varying degrees. Some of this depends upon our background and perhaps our inborn temperament, just exactly the way in which we express our hostilities or tend to nurse them. And sometimes it's the surface eruptions that we enjoy in quotes, for relatively brief times. Sudden but short-lived, sort of like an occasional flying cockroach that flies through our room. And these can be short outbursts of temper or occasional critical attitudes or those nasty little meannesses that crop up now and then, mental arguments or brief fantasies about how we'd like to get even. These are sort of like occasional garbage strewn around in our thought life that burst out sometimes into action. It can be those irritations at interruptions or the resentment at being imposed upon, even that little flash of resentment that we don't harbor very long, or mild aversions toward certain people or groups or types of personality. And then there are the strong undercurrents of resentment, deep bitternesses that color our interpretation of everything that happens in some relationship. And it filters out into our conversation all the time. And it erupts frequently into hot war. Or it issues in a long cold war. And either is equally destructive. These are more like the cockroaches and ants swarming all over our kitchen, in all the drawers and all the cabinets. And it involves deep feelings of being cheated or being used by other people. A constant complaining and murmuring, at least inside. A continual dribbles of whining or criticism. It's sort of like a grumbling volcano threatening all the time a major eruption and now and then having one, but the rest of the time often oozing hot lava over the edge of the crater. Or it can be like an icy withdrawal, an inner ice chamber. And it causes icy withdrawal. This may be obvious or less obvious. It may be just a sort of a reserve that holds us back from truly close relationships, sort of a non-involved coolness and not really caring. And then, deeper down inside, are those ferocious tigers and fierce dragons, hid down in the deep caves of our subconscious minds, where maybe we've forgotten them. They were so terrible and so frightening to us, the fear even of what might happen if they controlled, that we maybe just denied that we even had them and pushed them down long ago. But they still may scratch and claw and exude fire down inside in a damaging way. This can be huge piles of garbage in our subconscious mind that are literally alive with cockroaches and maggots. And These deep repressed hostilities may be against other people, or against ourselves, or against God, or often against all three. You know, it's important that we see the effects of hostility, because sometimes we can be complacent about our hostilities because we fail to realize the damage they do. We can have some of these detrimental effects that I'm going to mention in our lives without recognizing the source. And so we try to deal with the symptoms and never get to the cause. And as I mentioned before, some of these effects that we're going to talk about can be like the fin of that shark showing through the surface of our lives. Or like smoke giving evidence that there's a fire smoldering down there somewhere. And the Bible warns repeatedly against unresolved hostilities and gives us resources for overcoming them because of the destructive effect they have upon our own lives and other people. Dr. Maurice Wagner, I've quoted it in the initial part of your notes, a psychologist in Southern California, compares hostility to the appliance in the kitchen that when it goes on, it distorts the TV picture, making little lines go through it so you miss the whole plot. And so love may be radiating from other people to us or from God to us or even from the person we hate toward us. But if hostility puts little lines through our receiving apparatus, we don't receive it. We don't get the benefit of it. How can I want to receive love from you if I detest you? And when we're hostile, we're starving our own selves out from the things we need to meet the deepest needs of our lives. Hostility kills belongingness. And this often happens in a marriage relationship. You know, it can cause partners to just bulldoze through their conflicts or retreat into sort of an icy cold war, as we mentioned, rather than truly cooperating and resolving them. It can allow resentments to build up, or we can carry over old hostilities and displace them on our partner till we reach the place where we really just don't feel any love any longer and we fear our love has died forever. Well, you know, I wonder how the husband feels. We may feel cold and turned off and hot and angry even. But you know, the husband, his feelings are described in the book of Proverbs. It says, it's better to live in a lonely desert than with a contentious and angry woman. And then later it says that she's like an endless dripping on a rainy day. Drip, drip, drip. Maddening. But you know, the solution is not the divorce court. For one thing, if we flee from unpleasant situations, we're only postponing the solving of the true problem, which is within us. And I'm not saying it's not within our husband, too. But someone has to begin to take the steps to solve the problem within themselves instead of trying to get the other person to flee. And divorce does not resolve hostility deep in the heart. And if only for the woman's sake, she needs a deeper solution. Now, accumulated grudges eventually can affect the whole personality. We can become more and more defensive and less able to communicate. And we can increasingly lose our ability to see things the way they really are. And our efficiency can be lowered. And gradually, the hostility can extend to more and more people till eventually it becomes a generalized personality trait. Eventually, it can make us hate everybody and not want anybody. Not want to love anybody. The more angry you get, the more disturbed you'll be. For example, in a mental hospital, hostility is usually one quality that all of them have, besides other problems. But it wipes out all cohesiveness and cooperation in the hospital. Two workers can manage as many as 124 patients. And someone told the story that one time a worker was left alone and an inmate attacked him. He was very angry for something that happened that morning. He attacked him and he shouted out to the others, let's get him. And no one would join him. Although they also had hostilities against that guy because they thought, let him fight his own battles. No cohesiveness. Now, under our acute hostility, or sometimes beneath a sweet, calm exterior, we can have deep feelings of repressed hostility. And these can produce rigidity and coldness in our personality, either obvious or just a feeling of coldness in being able to experience warm love and other positive emotions. And Dr. Wagner said that hostility can lay in the bottom of our minds like sediment on our soul and make us feel we really don't love people. We've tried to all our lives and we really want to, but we just really don't care that much if we're honest. And this can be hostility under a sugar coating of love. And there's bitterness locked down inside and we guard against it. Hostility can ferment into other problems, such as depression or anxiety, critical attitudes, scapegoating, irritableness, some of these things that aren't so obvious, and they let us go feeling that we're good people compared to those obviously hostile bad people. And hostility was intended to protect us, but it does the opposite if we handle it unwisely. In the book of Proverbs in chapter 25, we read that he that has no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls. Such a city is vulnerable and easily defeated and easily invaded by the very persons that are hated. And you know, the person that you dislike actually controls you, your life by remote control. An obvious example of this is when you cross the street to avoid them. They are controlling you. Or when a wife has deep hostilities against her parents for other reasons, but obviously because they disapproved her marriage. So she puts unnecessary strains on her marriage by always trying to make it a perfect marriage to prove to them that she was right. And it can cause problems. And whether hostility is repressed or expressed, it can cause physical damage. There's a long list of illnesses that are caused by, or at least contributed to, by hostility. And we have a supplementary paper called Emotions and Health that you might find challenging and might give you some insights. Doctors could be wrong in some of the things they attribute to emotions because they don't know all the physical causes of everything yet. But it's obviously that many, many illnesses are rooted in emotional struggles. Obviously, it has a severe effect on our loved ones. Christine is an extreme example. But someone has well said that the venom of our hostility poisons ourselves more than the other person. And when strong acid is kept in an unsuitable container, it erodes the container far more than it hurts the people it splashes out on a little bit now and then, or even a lot. And the human psyche was not designed to hold hostilities. The long-range effect of hostility in our lives is very uninviting, because hostility does not mellow with mere age. And do I want to become a bitter, ugly old woman? If I do, I better nurse my grudges and throw temper tantrums at least now and then, or at least let the repressed hostilities in my life lay rest there, undisturbed by the light of truth. And as Washington Irving once says, a sharp tongue is the only edged tool that grows keener with constant use. But even more sobering to the person who has tasted the sweetness of God's forgiveness and the richness of his presence in their lives is what hostility does to our spiritual lives. Cecil Osborne said that we are not eligible to experience God's blessing, either his forgiveness or his guidance, so long as we're filled with resentment. And no wonder Jesus warned so strongly against hostility, against harboring enmity. In Matthew 5, one of his famous passages about this, he didn't say it was wrong to feel anger, but the Greek word means a continued anger, one that we nurse. And it says that if we continue to be angry with our brother or harbor malice in our lives, we're going to suffer for it. And then he said there will be even more severe suffering for those who speak contemptuously and insultingly toward their brother, or even more for the one who calls him, "You cursed fool, you empty-headed idiot." Jesus really condemned continued hostility because of its bad effects. Now, there are ways of handling hostility that are harmful or at least temporary. And three common ways, you can later on, and farther on in your notes, study them a little bit more. One is expressing it indiscriminately, and another is holding it in and nurturing it, and another is repressing it. We've touched upon these a little bit already. And a fourth is our rationalizing, justifying, excusing ourselves and blaming other people. We may blame heredity, circumstances. And I like the quote that says, circumstances don't make or break you, they reveal you. And the revealing is often good because we can deal with what we know is there. Now you may say, but because of what's happened to me, I have a right to feel this way and to act this way. Yes. You also have a right to go bang your head against a stone wall if you want to. And you also have a right, so to speak, to go jump from a 16th floor window if you want to, but if you do it, you will not escape the results. Another harmful way is projection. We're quick to attribute hostility to other people rather than criticize ourselves in a constructive way. Another is rehearsing our problem over and over and over. How terrible our situation is and how wrongly other people have treated us, and going over the unhappy situations and the past failures. We may do this to one person all the time or to everyone we meet in any extensive way, and it perpetuates and intensifies. It's different than the healthy communicating with someone who can help us. And another is releasing or expressing it in a harmless way. This can truly be a temporary help. It's sort of like the painkiller that the doctor gives us on the way to the hospital for the operation. It's no substitute for deeper deliverance, but it can help. For instance, walk around the block, or scrub the floor, or hit your son's punching bag for a while. Like a man who discovered it's better to slam the door than punch your mother-in-law because she called the police and he was sent to jail. Or you can write a letter and in it write fast and get your exact feelings out, especially if you have a hard time recognizing them. And then hide it for a day and then burn it. And these things can help harness our hostilities if we go on and couple them or supplement them with deeper helps. Let's take a look at the causes of our hostility. I don't think we want to be swatting flies all our lives. We'd rather clean out the breeding ground. And in any tropical setting, as we ladies well know here, it's impossible once for all, for instance, to eliminate ants from your household. But you can either just use a spray day by day to kill the immediate intruders. That's sort of helpful. Or you can carefully always keep things tightly covered that might attract them, and put out appropriate poison that they carry down to the nest, and the whole stream is gone for a long time, and it can keep our house free from them most of the time. And if we know the causes, we can find corresponding solutions that can give us much greater deliverance. Now, there are some things, some immediate triggers of hostility that we want to mention. And the immediate cause of hostility is almost always not getting what I want. In other words, thwarted desires. Now, I may merely want things to be fair. And so I keep score, and then according to my reckoning, you are cheating me, or you are taking advantage of me in some way. A woman may want her husband to love her in a particular way. And her husband, maybe the way her father showed love to her mother, and her husband insists on going on loving her in his way. And she doesn't get what she wants, so she's hostile. And when hostility is triggered, it comes out in the form, inwardly or outwardly, I'll make you give me what I want. I'll make you act so that I'll feel better about myself. Or at least if I get angry, I'll temporarily feel better. And it can be triggered by not getting what we want in three ways. One is frustration. Not getting what I want in terms of plans. My plans just didn't work out. The telephone rang just as I was rushing to that appointment. Or someone got ahead of me in the grocery line. Or you went and parked your car where I would hit it. Or someone Someone put that pole there and didn't notify me, and I backed into it. Or maybe I'm angry with the children for constant interruptions when I'm trying to get a guest meal ready. And my sovereignty is insulted, and I can't master things to make them go the way I want, so I am hostile. Another is humiliation, not getting what I want in terms of status. You may imply that I'm not good. You may say something that makes me think you don't like my lecture. Be careful. Or I may get passed up in a promotion or not elected or nominated for something that I want. This brings me down in status. And I try to regain my feeling of importance by being hostile, whether I show it or not. And in that inner fight, I sort of revive my feeling of being important after all, but it doesn't last long. And another is rejection, not getting what I want in terms of love. I've lost some love object. I've been excluded from some group or some friendship that I desire. Someone important to me doesn't seem to care about me. Or someone corrects me and I take it as rejection. So I feel hostile. But under these immediate triggers of hostility are longer range underlying causes. And it helps for us to consider hostility to be a sign of something wrong deeper in our personality, sort of like pain is a sign that something's wrong physically. There's a close interrelationship between the causes, the deeper causes of hostility that I'm going to mention. They hang on to one another, sort of. And the first one is lack of true identity. Most or all of our hostilities arise out of something that exposes our false identity, maybe only to ourselves, but it's a threat to us. Some person or situation makes me doubt my feeling that I can handle life and I'm strong and adequate. It breaks through and shows that that's false and I'm threatened. Or it confirms something that I fear is true about me. Maybe I'm afraid that I should be strong and adequate, but I'm not. And then something happens that confirms my fear. And so I feel hostile. And hostility goes hand in hand with a false self-image or a low self-image. If you see someone as easily angered, or someone that is constantly critical of other people, you can know that down somewhere inside lies an insecure and easily threatened self-image. We're trying to find our basic assurance about ourselves from the approval of people, how well we do in our performance, how nice we look, how important we are in our status, rather than getting our basic support from God. You know, when I first began to think about hostility in relationship to identity, it was quite a few years ago when my children were still rather small. And the hostility problem that was most likely to emerge in my life was an impatience and irritability with the children. And it bothered me when this came up. And as I became more aware of the basic causes of my reactions, I began to see that it was indeed rooted in my identity, that I would unconsciously slip back into finding my identity in performing well as a mother, being a successful mother. And then inevitably the children would do something that would make me feel unsuccessful. If I had been a better mother, that would have been taken care of long ago. And so I was threatened, and so I became irritable and harsh in my discipline, as though I could teach them by my harsh attitude. And pinpointing the cause was a big step toward finding a more consistent release. Now, not only is lack of true identity one of the long-range causes, but also false beliefs are. Unrealistic thought patterns that are rooted in false beliefs. I've already mentioned the false belief that I'm supposed to be an adequate person, or I am an adequate person in myself. And these false beliefs undergird our hostilities and make them seem like the most promising way to cope with life. And we have some supplementary notes available called God's Pattern for Harnessing My Hostilities. And these will give a series of false and true positions that specially relate to hostility. And if you would carefully study these and learn to discern what you really believe down inside on some of these things, I believe it could be a great help in overcoming, because our hostilities are rooted in false beliefs. For instance, a person may believe, I'm just a terrible person, I'm unworthy of love, and I'm really worse than most people. And she's frustrated by her incapacities and inabilities and hostile against herself. And this, she discharges this inner resentment by disliking people who have what it takes, perhaps. And another person may believe, deep inside, I'm the important one and I should have my way. Or I'm extra special and you should cater to me. I should be the center of things. I should control. I obviously know better. And when reality pierces through this false belief and attacks it, then we become hostile. Other false beliefs or positions are you can't trust people. If you're not very careful, they'll take advantage of you or gyp you all the time. Or God isn't being fair. He's overlooking my rights. Many false beliefs undergird our hostilities. And they're also rooted in immature behavior patterns, immature thought patterns, inappropriate immaturities in our lives. Hostility especially arises in my life when something happens that triggers open my inner emotional album that we've talked about in previous lectures to the stage two island of immaturity there. And this reactivates some of those old mental traces that I made back when I was two and back when I was four of how to cope with life. And I begin to base my identity on being able to control reality, to make it give me what I want. Doesn't that sound like a two-year-old? He's not really investing himself yet in the well-being of others, but he's trying to make reality meet his needs. If you don't do it, I'll make you. And the amount of hostility in my life, whether it be obvious or just that little fin showing over the surface, and there's a lot underneath, provides a fairly good indicator of how much time I spend on island two, like a two-year-old or a four- or five-year-old. And we often demonstrate our hostility in the very ways that we found successful back there. If a child habitually responds to difficulties by becoming angry, and if the parents capitulate to him in order to appease him, then he's likely to do the same at work or at home as an adult. Or maybe hostile feelings were outlawed in the home as the king of all evil. Don't you ever feel any hostility. And so they were repressed and denied. I'm not saying that they should be allowed to be expressed indiscriminately, but in this case, they're so shameful that the child learns not to even admit them. And later on in life, he'll do the same thing. And then he may step from island two, where the hostility arose, down to island one, stage one of emotional maturity, into a sense of self-condemnation or depression. Another way that I may have learned how to respond in stage two is by watching if I had a parent who gave me constant lessons of living in that stage. And so our problem lies in deeply ingrained, immature patterns of thought and action and belief that chooses to get our needs met by controlling others or changing others. And these things can be changed, though. They can't be obliterated, those memory traces, but they can be superseded by new beliefs and new patterns in our lives. And another deep underlying cause is transference, or subtle interchanges that we make within our defensive emotions. You know, have you ever met a woman you couldn't stand? And there's no reason. She's a lovely person. And later on it dawns on you that she reminds you in some ways of that nasty little redhead that stole your boyfriend when you were in the sixth grade. And you're transferring that inner hostility that was never resolved over to this nice woman that you met. You can do it to our husbands. We can transfer hostility that we really felt toward our father and transfer it over to our husbands. And we make subtle switches among our defensive emotions because we may feel that one is more acceptable than another. If our basic problem may really be guilt, like a wife may feel very guilty for failing in her role as a wife, and she may take it out in anger on her husband. Or we may find that we long for release from hostility, but the real problem is fear. Fear of being dominated. Fear of being wrong or of losing security or approval, identity. And so there can be fear or lack of courage or cowardice under our hostility. And for the person who has a false identity of being strong, it's really hard to admit, I'm really fearful. That's the cause of it all. But it's important to be realistic if we want release. There can be underneath our hostility a self-hate or deep guilt that we've long buried. And there's a page in your note on self-hatred that I would suggest looking through later. We also have some supplementary notes called those basic hostilities that are available. And, you know, because often underneath our surface hostilities or even our hidden ones is a deep resentment toward God, maybe for the kind of person that He made us, a deep lack of self-acceptance. And those notes can be a great help, I feel, in deepening our self-acceptance and resolving some hidden hostilities toward God that we may have. Now, from these long-range causes, we come to some conclusions. And one is that we're very complex and intricately made. And therefore, let's not go around as amateur psychologists trying to analyze everyone else. Yes, you may gain some insights that help you relate to other people and meet their needs better, to your children, to your husband. And you may find some insights that help you to deal with or to give further insights to people who come to you disturbed about their hostilities. But let's make sure that our primary application is to our own lives, because we have a lifelong task in really learning to know ourselves. And we don't have to figure out our entire inner situation in order to start experiencing some release. Like I mentioned, the tremendous release that began to come into my life when I dealt with my surface hostility toward my sister and started to experience Christ as my very life. We don't have to understand everything to start experiencing love and release. But it does take a lifetime to go on to be transformed more and more completely. And the illustration of an iceberg helps here. If we deal with the obvious problem and realistically begin to cope with it and find out the thought patterns beneath it, if we can, and then, like an iceberg, if you chip off the top, then some more will rise, and then there's more exposed, and you keep chipping, and finally, the iceberg, that thing in our lives that brings coldness or whatever it is, can be more and more lessened. But in the process, we can have a wonderful, vital, joyous relationship with God. We don't have to wait to understand everything. But we do have to gain insights. We can gain it through God's Word as we absorb and let Him speak to us. We can gain insights through relationships with other people, through careful study of some of the notes that you've gotten today. If you just come and listen, you probably won't gain much long-range help. But if you take time to think and review and absorb the truths, you'll gain more. We can gain insights through small group Bible studies. That's one reason why I feel that the ones that we have are so important. Because sometimes closer relationships with other people where we can be honest can help in resolving and gaining insights. And another conclusion is that we should have compassion for the hostile person rather than sort of a condemning attitude, giving them the feeling you're just terrible. Whether that hostile person be ourselves or other people. A hostile person is someone with deep needs, like we all have, but they're trying to meet them in self-defeating ways. And we need to have compassion because, as one man wrote, the only worse thing than living with a hostile person is having to live with our own hostilities. And we have to learn God's attitude because He accepts His children, flawed and hostile, though He may disapprove some of the attitudes and actions. And we have to accept ourselves and others with the same in the same way. And another thing is important to stop minimizing or justifying or excusing our hostilities if we realize how harmful they are in our lives. If we think that they're sort of our little friends, our little pets, well, let's pat that little cockroach for a few minutes before we swat it. Then we're not going to deal with them realistically. We're going to let the traces of how to react with hostility and with immaturity become deeper in our minds. And we need to challenge our hatred against the real enemy, which is within us. We got to develop some revolting feelings against the idea that my past is dominating me. I don't want to let it dominate me. I think I'm such a free person by expressing my hostilities. I'm really being dominated by the past. And it's destroying the chances of becoming the person I was meant to be. Now, the inner enemy, the basic inner enemy, in terms that the Bible often uses, is the flesh. It doesn't mean our physical sustenance, our physical bodies. It means the lower nature, the patterns, the old memory traces that have been written there whenever we live independent of God. And the flesh, or the lower nature, parades under a false identity. It says, I'm really you. And I'm really your friend. And it's really not our true self. It's a traitor within that wants to act as if it's our champion and our life preserver, but really it's like quicksand that draws us under. And if we can begin to hate the false part of us, then we can begin to harness our hostilities against the true enemy. That can be the beginning of a solution. But we have to find in-depth solutions, or else we go on swatting cockroaches all our lives, or petting them. Or they proliferate, grow and breed, till they become more and more prominent in our homes. You know, in a tropical country, you can never banish cockroaches once for all. At least if you found a way, let me know. I hate them. If I see one, I have an inner compulsion to take off my little shoe and go after them. We can go after them that way, one by one, in partial panic, as they crawl around our kitchen or fly around in that terrifying way they sometimes have. Or we can put out enough poison often enough and take other precautions so that they relatively rarely bother us. Now, our basic problem with harnessing our hostilities is that instead of responding to God and to the truth and the inner power and the patterns that He has provided, we try to handle things our own way. We want to take care of it ourselves so we'll feel we're really somebody. And so our whole psychological life can increasingly become a dark breeding place. And the hostilities can infest more and more of our inner being. You know, it's possible to learn to confine these hostilities, instead of letting the garbage be scattered around in our minds, to confine it in a container with a tight cover. And it's possible to discover disinfectants that will thoroughly cleanse deep inside, and appropriate poisons, like with ants. I found a poison that they can carry right down to the nest. And since then, I rarely have them. I can get rid of the whole stream frequently and just not have them very often. And we can find these things in our psychological and spiritual lives. But in order to do so, we need a twofold program, so to speak, that deals with our inner and our outer life, both. We need a twofold approach. And inwardly, we need to learn the truth so that our thought patterns can be changed. And so that whenever the false beliefs come up and control us, they can be supplanted or cut through with the truth. There was a great Scottish Bible teacher named George Duncan who said that in the depths of our minds there's a fearful accumulation of thoughts and emotions, and it's the depths of our personality that need cleansing. And often we're in danger of dealing with the surface only, like the child who washes his hands and face and thinks that he's clean. And he needs more than that, especially before bedtime. And God has provided truth for us to live by, truth that we need to let soak into our inner being. And God's truth has two aspects. One is the word that he has given, which is truth. And another is his son whom he sent, who said, "I am the truth." He lived his life totally in accord with reality. What he spoke was truth. There was no sham, no pretense, no deceit, no false thoughts controlling his life. He is the truth. And as we, his presence in our lives and his word in our lives, his written, spoken word, act as disinfectants to cleanse deep within. And we have to let it penetrate our life. And it can be the poison that clears out, that kills destructive emotions. You know, Christ can be the dragon slayer, the tiger cager deep within us, if we let him. And he can clear out the garbage of our false beliefs and detrimental thoughts whenever they get strewn around in our psychological lives. There are certain truths that are especially significant in handling hostilities. And some of these truths are about ourselves. You know, sometimes what needs to be corrected is a unrealistically high self-image on the surface, at least. It often covers self-rejection underneath. But sort of the attitude, you are such a sinner and you need help. And Christ makes us admit, I am equally a sinner. I am equally in need. We're in this together. And then he comes in and shows us that he loves us so immeasurably that he died for us. And that we're all totally needy of his forgiveness. We have no business pointing our fingers at one another as though we are superior. And another person feels, I'm terrible. Who could love or forgive me? And he feels weak and inadequate and compared to others. And this thought feeds his hostility toward those who have it. And then the truth breaks through. Well, we're all sinners. We're all unlovely in God's sight until we're cleansed. And the strong people that I have cowered before all my life are also weak underneath. And they're inadequate too and fearful. And so we begin to realize that we're all needy, but we all have the same resources offered us. And we mentioned before that one of the great false beliefs that hinders our appropriating God's work in our lives is the belief that I can do it on my own. Just give me enough time and I'll take care of these hostilities and I'll produce that beautiful love toward other people. If I can't, I at least should be able to. And the Apostle Paul wrote something that cuts this through. He, even in his, as a rather outstanding Christian, said that I know that in me, that is in my flesh or my lower self, the part of me that wants to operate independent of God, there dwells no good thing. For there is the desire to do the right, but not the power. And so God disperses our feeling that we should be able to do it ourselves and moves in with his liberating presence when we admit our need. You know, when truth breaks through, we realize that by our own self-effort, we can tie very pretty artificial fruit on the boughs of our lives. But it is so untasty and false compared with that beautiful, expendable love that Christ can produce in our lives. Then there are truths about God. There are a number that I find tremendously relative to my hostility. And one is that God is sovereign. He's the supreme ruler. He's the one who is meant to control my life. That's the way I was designed to be, with God the controller, God in the central position behind the wheel. And you know, as I realize the truth that he is lovingly involved in my situation, if I let him be, and that he's able to work it for good, he's promised to, if I let him, he has unlimited power so that my problem is nothing to him. That helps to release me from my hostile feeling that it all depends on me, so I've got to change it all. And another thing, if I'm a child of the King, if I have received Christ into my life, then I'm the child of the supreme ruler of all. And I don't need to act like a beggar, scrounging around and clawing my way through life to gain crumbs of inner support or to defend my rights. Because God loves me, though I'm flawed and hostile, and God will take care of me. And another truth that's rather helpful is that God has certain official prerogatives, and I'm not to usurp them. He says that he is my protector and my defender and my champion, and that he's the vindicator of my rights. He's the judge of all men. The other person is not answerable to me, but to him. And he's more interested in righting wrongs in life and transforming people than I am. But then another thing, besides the fact that he is sovereign, the supreme ruler, is the fact that he is Savior. And he offers two things, among others. One is total forgiveness because of Christ's work on the cross. God is gracious and forgiving. And Jesus revealed this when, as he was dying on the cross at the hands of hostile men, he prayed, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And he paid for the guilt of our sins. And God is ready and eager to forgive both me and the other person. He wanted this privilege so badly that he let his son suffer incredibly for our sake. His son personally bore our sins in his body on the cross. And it was the suffering that he bore that heals us deep inside, that produces forgiveness in us. And our part is simply to believe. Not to reform ourselves and then come to him, but to simply believe what he did for us, that he died and rose again, and open our hearts, asking him in for a permanent inner relationship. His forgiveness is received not by merit, but by faith in him and his sacrifice. And then he provides not only forgiveness through Christ's work on the cross, but he provides expendable love through Christ's work in me now. And this again is received by faith, not by trying to be something, but by letting him live in me. I just love the verse in the 13th chapter of 2 Corinthians that says that the Christ you have to deal with is not a weak person outside you, but a tremendous power inside you. And he's powerful enough to be the dragon slayer and the lion tamer and the tiger cager. But you know, the exciting thing is that when we let him live in us, just by simple faith, he brings more than just freedom from our hostilities. He brings more than mere neutrality. He enables us increasingly to love people with that deep, expendable love of his. And to have our relationships transformed. And his plan is not just sort of a tentative peace with others that you've got to be very careful or it will disrupt again into hot war. But his plan is to produce in us an unpretended and cordial and consistent love. And in the book of First, Paul prayed, "May the Lord make your love for one another and for everyone abundant and running over, just as ours is for you." God is the producer of expendable love in us as we let him. Then we need truths about how life runs well. And one of the basic truths here is that life runs well when we let God be God in our lives. This lets our lives function and unfold with the beauty that God had in mind when he designed us. Anything else is a perversion of what we were meant to be. And the opposite of letting him be God is stage two, where I control things to get what I want, and I'll show you. I'll change. You better change. I'll make you if you don't agree to. And it's the opposite of the stage three position that sets me up as the judge. Now, I'll sort of keep score here to make sure all is fair. And then if it isn't, then I'll step back into stage two and show you and make sure that they're evened out. Now, if God is to be God in my life, I need two things. I need to just simply believe him. Faith. Believe what he tells me. Trust him to forgive me. Count on his life in me as all that I need for power and love and resources. And count on his power in my situation to handle it better than I can. And then I need, second, to submit to him as a person, to obey his word and follow his patterns. And submitting to his loving control means yielding my whole person to him. Is that difficult if we realize how deeply he loves us, more than we possibly could love ourselves? And I'm to yield to him my personal rights and my hostilities and my independent solutions and my attempt to change and punish the other person. I'm to take time in his presence, opening up my inner being wide to him and saying, God, I want you to move down into the depths where I can't even see, and transform and disinfect and heal. That's submission. And Dr. Wagner, the psychologist I mentioned before, has a very, I think, very pointed and clear description of what it means to believe and submit to God when hostility takes over in our lives. He says that hostility is an assertion of my feeling that I'm like God, that I'm God, I'm sovereign, and I have some rights around here, and I have a prior claim to what I want. And you know, this is a terrible contradiction to letting God be Lord. There's trouble in the camp because you've got two bosses. God is supposed to be the loving boss inside, and I'm insisting on being it myself. And a house divided against itself is going to fall. And so we feel that, I feel maybe that I have to have my way. I have to punish someone for all those feelings pent up inside me. And Wagner says, you think you have a right to. What they did was unfair. But you know, God says he will repay. And God says every person belongs to him. Everyone is directly owned by him and answerable to him. And if I am angry at you, I'm taking God's place. I'm stepping into his shoes. That is the worst sin. He's already seen what you did. And you know, if you've been unfair to me, truly unfair to me, then you're in trouble with God, because God will teach you. But why can't I trust God to do it? Why do I have to get in the act? Am I better than God? Do I know better how to handle it? And so he says that God says, now I'll take care of the other person, and I'll take care of my children in my own way, and don't you try to punish anybody. Can't I trust God to do this? And so Mr. Wagner says that when anger swells within you, simply say, all right, Lord, you take care of it. I'm yours. And it's yours to discipline. And you give me sweetness in my heart. You cleanse me. And this is not repression. This is admitting our feelings honestly and discharging our idea about it to God and then letting him control. And so he uses the illustration that when I am hostile toward you, it's like a tug of war. This inner or outer tug of war. And I can find release if I will take my end of the rope and put it in God's hand and let him be God. And if 2 minutes later I find myself taking it back again, put it back in his hand again. And this brings deep inner release. There are some truths that I often feed into my thought processes and let the Holy Spirit carry them down in deep that help here. One is in the book of Psalms that says, commit your way unto the Lord, trust also in him, and he will act. And he will bring forth your vindication as the light and your right as the noonday. He will act. He will vindicate. He'll take care of my rights. And then another is one in 2 Chronicles that just says, the battle is not yours, but God. That's a nice short one. that often just enables me to put the rope in God's hand. And then another is in Psalm 46, be still and know that I am God. Or as the margin says, be still, relax, cease striving, and know that I am God. And peace and love replace the hostility because of the powerful presence of Christ within. This is the inner approach. But there's also an outer approach that we need through his power in our actions. We don't have time to cover it this morning. We could take a whole second session on it. But I've provided rather thorough notes that I really encourage you to get. It's called God's Pattern for Harnessing My Hostilities. And it's really packed with practical helps. I mentioned that it contains those false and true positions that are especially related to hostility, some of them. And it gives helps on how to move toward reconciliation. How can I do it effectively, and when should I make the first move? And it gives ideas for cultivating better communication patterns and for demonstrating love in tangible ways. And it gives insights into how to treat a situation if there's been a prolonged cold and hot war that's been so long that communication is impossible now. Now, one of the women told me the other day, she says, you know, I had had this paper previously, and I've redone it, and in more helpful form, I feel. But she said that her paper is just wrinkled and creased. It's almost ready to fall apart because she found it so helpful. And I would really encourage you to get it and do some careful thinking about it. And then the third thing is submitting to the process of growth, because total release does not come overnight. We gain increasingly great release in our lives as Christ moves into more and more the depths of our personality as the years go by, as the months go by. Growth takes place as we face the situations in which God places us, not running away from them, but facing them, and let him weave the truth into our actual experience. And you know, difficult situations are sort of, they chase the cockroaches out. And so we realize, oh, there must be some breeding places underneath that I'd forgotten about. Or they part the water so we see there's a shark underneath. Or they lift up the rocks and cause all the insects to flee, and then Christ can disinfect and poison them out. But you know, although it's a lifelong process, we don't have to wait for months or years to begin to experience special release. And his powerful presence can begin to harness our hostilities if we let him flow, if we've allowed him to enter our lives, and then let him flow from that inner core of our being, our spirit, into our emotions, into our minds, into our wills, with his truth, his spoken, written word, and let him penetrate and dispel and harness our inner hostilities. And one of the great evidences of what Christ can do in lives is found, and one of the great evidences of the very fact that God truly exists is found in the profound change that takes place in lives when Christ enters. And I was very impressed with a story told by Ernest Gordon in the book The Valley of the Kwai. It's a dramatic story of the power of God. And these men during World War II were prisoners of the Japanese up in the Malay Peninsula. And they had been reduced almost to animals.